Did media coverage of a rigged public opinion poll and a threat from a Somali-based terror group to attack the West Edmonton Mall constitute a deliberate public relations campaign in support of the Canadian government's anti-terrorism legislation? To what extent is this kind of media messaging typical in the context of government legislation restricting civil liberties? Is Canada becoming a fascist state under Stephen Harper? What exactly is in the current anti-terrorism legislation before the Canadian House of Commons that should concern the citizens of the country? As the Anti-Terrorism Act is coming before the House of Commons, we will examine the role the mainstream media is playing in bullying parliamentarians and the Canadian public into accepting this intrusive legislation and whether this phenomenon is unique or constitutes a familiar pattern historically. Author, journalist, and media critic Barry Zwicker will share his thoughts in this hour. On today's program, Fascist Canada Part 1, Bill C-51 in the Media Campaign. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 27th, 2015. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. It can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. During the recent measles outbreak, the mainstream media blamed the epidemic solely on non-vaccinated children, even though people who were vaccinated caught the disease and some vaccines have proven to be inefficient in the past. Without the slightest nuance, the mainstream media constantly portrays people reluctant to accept just any vaccine as anti-vaxxers, irresponsible and misinformed people, relying on irrational fears and the one and only fraudulent Andrew Wakefield study linking autism to vaccines. While some people may be totally against any kind of vaccination, many, including doctors and health specialists, question certain vaccines, ingredients in the vaccines, and/or the vaccination schedule. This is not based on a survey, but on my own perception resulting from the fair amount of articles on vaccines and the pharmaceutical industry that I've read over the last 5 years as a journalist. There are a large number of doctors and health specialists who have done truly independent research and who criticize vaccination based on scientific studies and solid evidence. That's from the article 25 Facts About the Pharmaceutical Industry, Vaccines and Anti-Vaxxers, by Julie Levesque, posted February 25th. Of course, NATO military exercises can occur anywhere, but why specifically are they taking place in Estonia at Russia's doorstep? And why are they displaying American flags right on the Russian border? And why now, with the resurgence of war in Ukraine? According to NATO, Putin has a destabilizing influence in the Baltics, and the Cold War is increasingly becoming a hot war. That comes from the article, U.S. NATO military convoy of tanks and armored vehicles at Russia's doorstep, rolling along the Estonia-Russia border, by Joost Niemöller, translated from the original Dutch, posted February 25th, originally appearing at joostniemöller.nl. Dr. Paul Thomas, M.D., is a board-certified fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics, who resides in Oregon. He took time out to attend the public hearing before the Oregon Senate Committee on Healthcare regarding Bill SB 442. This bill was written by Oregon State Senator and physician Elizabeth Steiner Hayward and seeks to remove all philosophical and religious exemptions to vaccines in the state of Oregon. Dr. Paul stated that this bill, as it is written, is, quote, a travesty, unquote. He states that the science is not settled, linking too many vaccines to autism, and that doctors like himself should not be coerced by bills like this one proposed in Oregon to give up the right to informed consent in regards to vaccines. That comes from the article Vaccines Linked to Autism, Preserve Medical Freedom, Dr. Paul Thomas, MD, by Health Impact News, posted February 25th. Whereas for FDR, the alliance with Sunni Islam was purely anti-communist against the Soviet Union, the U.S. presidents after 1980 were and are anti-Russian, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with ideology. The U.S. aristocracy intend to dominate the aristocracy in every other nation, and Russia is the only militarily powerful nation that is opposed to being controlled by this global empire. Consequently, President Obama, who is an agent for America's aristocracy, wants to cripple, if not destroy, Russia. And this is why, in his National Security Strategy 2015, 17 of the 18 times he uses the term aggression are applying it against Russia. Russia's President Putin would have to be an idiot not to recognize that today's United States, its aristocracy, not the American people, who are quite different, is extremely hostile. That comes from the article, What's Behind Ukraine's Secret Weapons Deal with the United Arab Emirates? By Eric Zeus, posted February 25th. NBC News reported, quote, Germans were confronted with images of their country's dark past when German public broadcaster ZDF showed video of Ukrainian soldiers with Nazi symbols on their helmets in its evening newscast, unquote. But it's now clear that far-right extremism is not limited to the militias sent to kill ethnic Russians in the East or to the presence of a few neo-Nazi officials who were rewarded for their roles in last February's coup. The fanaticism is present at the center of the Kiev regime, including its deputy foreign minister who speaks casually about a full-scale war with nuclear-armed Russia. In a normal world, U.S. and European journalists would explain to their readers how insane all this is, how a dispute over the pace for implementing a European association agreement while also maintaining some economic ties with Russia could have been worked out within the Ukrainian political system, that it was not grounds for a U.S.-backed regime change last February, let alone a civil war, and surely not nuclear war. To a degree that I have not seen in my 37 years covering Washington, there is a totalitarian quality to the West's current groupthink about Ukraine, with virtually no one who matters deviating from the black-and-white depiction of good guys in Kiev versus bad guys in Donetsk and Moscow. That comes from the article Ready for Nuclear War Over Ukraine by Robert Perry, posted February 25th, originally appearing at Consortium News. The Guardian has reported that Chicago police are operating a secret detention facility that mirrors the CIA's black sites. From violations of due process to torture, the revelations raise serious concerns about the deteriorating state of freedom and justice in the United States. James Trainum, a former Washington, D.C. detective, believes Homan is the only facility of its kind in the United States. Considering the high level of security, it is plausible that others exist but remain undiscovered. Trainum told The Guardian, quote, I've never known any kind of organized secret place where they go and just hold somebody before booking for hours and hours and hours. That scares the hell out of me that that even exists or might exist. Unquote. That comes from the article, Chicago Police Caught Disappearing People into Secret CIA-Style Detention Center, by Carrie Wedler, posted February 25th, originally appearing at the Anti-Media. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. To to discuss with us more about the media campaign around the passage on second reading of the anti-terrorism legislation, we're joined right now from Toronto by author, journalist, and media critic Barry Zwicker. Barry Zwicker has spent 7 decades in the journalistic realm, former Manitoban. He is currently blogging for Truth and Shadows and is working on a book on false flag operations, tentatively called False Flag Operations, History's Deadliest Deceits and Why They Matter. Barry Zwicker, welcome once again to the Global Research NewsHour.
I'm pleased to be with you in Global Research.
Okay. Now, Barry, I was watching a lot of the I was watching the news coverage on the weekend, and in particular, I remember the CTV Newsnet. They were running every half hour. We were seeing footage of this threat of an attack against against Canadians by this figure behind a sort of a white and blue mask. It was really menacing, and they keep showing shots of this this figure alongside a threat that targets such as the West Edmonton Mall could be attacked, or just encouraging supporters to attack these outposts here in Canada. And this just happens to be the day before the anti-terrorism legislation was to be going to Parliament on second reading. Also, there was before that a poll that was published by the Globe and Mail and among other publications, noting the that this the anti-terrorism stance of the Harper government was a political juggernaut, quote unquote, and showing very high support for this very, call it draconian, anti-terrorism measures at the expense of liberty. And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are about this, because it seems very, especially with regard to that warning from the terror group Al-Shabaab about the West Edmonton Mall, it seemed to me, you know, if you were really wanting these attacks to be successful, you wouldn't want to have it come out the day before. So I wonder if you might want to comment on that and media coverage in general in the lead up to this the vote on the anti-terrorism legislation in the House.
Oh yes, well the timing, the timing is a virtual dead giveaway that you're dealing with a manufactured threat, and it was the same with the shooting at the National War Memorial on October the 22nd, on the very day that Harper was introducing his anti-terror legislation, or the latest iteration of it. So the Al-Shabaab threat against West Edmonton Mall, just to take your specific example, is an example of fabricated fear-mongering, and it has become increasingly obvious that this is so. And maybe in a minute we'll talk about mainstream media coverage and the way that even a number of veteran mainstream media commentators are catching on to this and are warning about it and are sending up the alarm bells about, well, what Thomas Walkham of the Toronto Star has called the theater of the absurd. He's talking about the so-called war on terror and these various alarums, and he calls it theater of the absurd. And it really is theater, and I say that as a theater lover. These things are staged, and there are various hallmarks that indicate that, and one of them is the timing. So there you had, with the West Edmonton Mall apparently coming under threat, you had the timing. Those the psychological warriors who invent these and have them disseminated by an all too compliant and naive media, although the media aren't always even naive, there are gatekeepers within the media, I think, who are actually menacing and planted there. But these psychological warriors, they know that generally people only read headlines, or they see brief items, as you did on CTV Newsnet, images on TV, a snippet online from the likes of Huffington Post or whatever. And these psychological warriors also know that human beings react viscerally to anything that resembles a threat. I mean, this goes right back to our earliest times as creatures. I mean, animals in the forest, react viscerally to a threat. It's just absolutely basic to living beings. And also these Psi warriors know that people have short memories. So you put all that together and you have to get the Al-Shabaab threatening the West Edmonton Mall, you know, just as this legislation is coming down the pike. Well, I might say whimsically that these bright guys who cook these scares up, they're forgetting that West Edmonton Mall has its own submarine fleet to protect it. Now, yeah. About the Angus Reid poll, I noticed that too. And of course, it was rather disheartening to read the results, where 80-some percent of Canadians apparently, say, yes, bring on the anti-terror legislation. And a small number, maybe 30-some percent, say, well, yeah, we do need to have it checked, you know, to make sure that liberties aren't being threatened. But the overall results to the various questions were really despairingly large in the support for the government column. However, we shouldn't be too disheartened at this, because even the media themselves warn, occasionally at least, about the unreliability of polls. But that's even as they simultaneously report these polls, and usually very uncritically. So they really, the media really play a double role there, a double movement within the media on polls. But the basic criticisms of polls are that they measure with varying degrees of accuracy public opinion at a particular moment in time. And so certainly that's the case with the Angus Reid poll. So if you ask a person who's just been bombarded with scary threats whether he or she feels threatened, of course you're going to get an instant yes. And then there's the overall criticism of polls, that even the pollsters in the past year or so have admitted that they're having major problems for various reasons. One is the changing nature of communications and so on. And you'll remember how the pollsters admitted that they called the last BC provincial election all wrong, except there was one single pollster got it, called it right. All the others were way off. They got the Ontario election called pretty well wrongly. And there are examples of pollsters all over the place whose faces are dripping with egg. But if you delve a little more into the details of this particular poll, this Angus Reid poll, there is a problem with the methodology. Now, that would be even if the measurement of the manufactured fright is probably valid. And there was, you might have noticed it, a letter to the editor of the Globe and Mail last Monday, and it was from somebody named, I've got it on my screen here, Thomas K. Burch, B-U-R-C-H, in Victoria. And he begins by giving his bona fides, if you will, that he's a demographer with many years' experience with statistical surveys. And he says of that poll, I think skepticism is in order for reasons of methodology as well as content. And then he goes on to quote that 82% of Canadians, quote, in every province, every age group, and across party lines are in favor of the bill. And that was from the Globe and Mail's report. And as you say, there was another Globe and Mail report that called it a political juggernaut.
Yes.
But then Mr. Birch goes on to say, but there are several reasons to suspend judgment. The respondents are not, in fact, a randomly selected sample of 1,509 Canadians, as the Globe reported. He says they are a random sample of persons who have joined the Angus Reid poll, a panel which itself is not a random sample of Canadian adults. Angus Reid polls, he says, are conducted online. Only persons with regular access to the Internet can join the panel. This means that 1 out of 5 adults in Canada is automatically excluded. The panel members are self-selected, and it's axiomatic that self-selected samples tend to be biased, and so on. So he really, and he has the background to make his opinions believable, he finds serious problems with that poll.
So should a pollster who would use a a poll of this nature with you know the kinds of sampling errors you just mentioned, how responsible is it for both for the pollster and for media outlets to publish headlines like that?
Well, it's in a word, I would say irresponsible. Certainly, the way the Globe see. By the way, when I'm myself speaking with you about the mainstream media, I have to say that what I'm talking about is mainly the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star and CBC Television. And in fact, I access those three daily. We get the Star and the Globe delivered to our doorstep every day, and my wife and I watch Pastor Mansbridge probably a good four nights out of five. And but of course, I hope your listeners would know that a person such as myself also pursues daily alerts from a lot of good alternative sites, such as Global Research, which is one of the very best, more than I could take time to mention. And I also get daily alerts from the Washington Post and the New York Times and so on. But the Globe and Mail, I have quite a bit of time for. I did work there for 8.5 years, but I'm not a, you know, naive or wet behind the ears, really. And yet I find that the Globe and Mail's, the quality of the Globe and Mail's reportage and commentary, and even in the case of Bill C-51, its editorials, I find are of extremely high quality. I don't mind saying that. Also, the Toronto Star's columnists, almost right across the board, and the Globe's columnists, right across the board, they are very much against C-51.
Yes, that's true.
Oh, it is, and I think credit should be given where credit's due. I just very quickly, for instance, I have the Star's website up on another screen here, and. If you just take the first, not I could take the first 20 headlines, can't go through 20, but just go through the first few headlines of stuff that's been in the Star. Parliament should give Harper's flawed anti-terror bill the scrutiny it merits. That's an editorial. Tom Mulcair urges proper scrutiny of government terror bill. Unnecessary terror bill to be rammed through Parliament. That's Tom Walkham. That's one of the columnists. Conservatives want to limit testimony and study of terror bill. Bill C-51 threatens to sacrifice liberty for security. That's an op-ed page piece. Stephen Harper's 11th hour embrace of unelected judges, and that's by Tim Harper, another columnist, and he says it's really hypocritical. And Prime Minister, this isn't how we do things in Canada. I mean, this is just, and they're, all of them are like that. There's 20 of them just on the first page, and I dare say it would be the same if you did the same on the Globe's website. Actually, I really enjoyed one of the early editorials the Globe did in its sharp criticism C-51. And here's how it started. It says, Liberal leader Justin Trudeau has announced his party will support the government's new anti-terrorism bill and sort out any vexing details later on. That's a bit, the Globe editorial writer writes, like buying a bull because you hope its excrement can be sold as perfume. So in other words, the Globe came as close as it could in polite company to calling C-51 bullshit.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I never thought I'd see the Globe and Mail editorial writers and the NDP as one on anything. And they are.
And Rex Murphy as well.
Even Rex.
Yeah, on
that
CBC.
That was a real shocker that he, because Rex is so damn predictable as being for the establishment and for all the bogus narratives you can trot out, and damned if he didn't do it too. You're right, Michael.
Now, I wanted to talk about the whole issue of media collusion with that establishment. And, I mean, you wrote a chapter for the book American Nancy Snow's book on war media and propaganda, Global Perspective. Your chapter was called America, the Fourth Reich. And you also included that in your book, Towers of Deception, the Media Cover-Up of 9/11. I'm just going to read a portion of it because I want to kind of extend the
look at the whole formulaic aspect of this. So you basically take a quote from William L. Shearer's book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, in which he writes, quote, "Beyond reasonable doubt, it was the Nazis who planned the arson and carried it out for their own political ends," unquote. "The idea for the fire," writes Scheer, this is the Reichstag fire, "almost certainly originated at the top, with Goebbels and Goering, Vice Chancellor von Pippen, recalled that when he arrived at the blazing parliament buildings, Goering was already on the scene shouting, quote, this is a communist crime, unquote. Hitler lost no time," Scheer writes, "in exploiting the Reichstag fire to the limit. The very next day, he prevailed on the president to sign a decree for the protection of the people and the state, suspending the 7 sections of the Constitution which guaranteed individual and civil liberties. It was described as a defensive measure against communist acts of violence against the state." And you state that the parallel with the events of 9/11 is stunning. And I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with that whole idea of the alacrity with which governments will move from one of these horrifying events to then bringing in this kind of legislation. But I think the key point is the media seems to be playing along. So I wonder if you could talk about how maybe take us, having given your background in the Globe and Mail and within mainstream media, a little bit about how that sausage factory works, where you can have media enabling these sorts of agendas, even though, as you just pointed out, individual writers and even editors can be against.
Well, it's a curious thing, and things are moving very quickly in the media landscape. We know that newspapers, for instance, and it's also true of television news, have suffered serious declines in audience and in trust. And this is a 20-year slide. There was a panel last night on CBC television news about how it was pegged on the fact that Brian Williams in the USA has been let go or suspended or something because he lied about something, but that was the peg, and so there's this long slide now. This is relevant. This is very relevant to the way journalists think, and I've been one of them, and I've been in the inside and the outside, and in fact, I continue in both worlds. I know a lot of people in the mainstream media. I identify with it. I worked at it so long. I have a feeling for how things work. I don't know everything, but I've got that feeling. So there are these, Tom Hopkins, a former West Coast bureau chief for Maclean's magazine, called invisible axioms. Invisible axioms. I love that phrase. As far as I know, he invented it. And that is things that people in the media just take as true without even thinking about them. Now, media people are as prone, I fear, to false narratives and being bulldozed into believing things because everyone just says they're true, they're givens, they're invisible axioms. And this infects people in the media to a surprisingly large extent. The way it does the general public. And as a matter of fact, the general public is not as naive, and I say this from a lifetime of observation. The general public is not as naive about what's going on in the world as professional journalists are in the mainstream media. They just aren't. Because, ever since 9/11, before 9/11, yes, and since 9/11, with 9/11 being the startling and stunning example, but also with all the false flag operations since London 7/7, the Madrid train bombings, and on and on, the mainstream media people, and I'm talking about the people, they just either don't get it, or they can't get it, or they're afraid of getting it, or they want to look the other way, and it's all loaded against this huge secret that's in plain sight being referred to, the elephant in the room. Now, when you mentioned, Michael, that nevertheless people, and I had just cited many of them too, Tom Walkham and many people in these two major media outlets, the Star and the Globe, that are very, very critical of C-51, but they are critical of it, as it were, on not a superficial basis, but on an insufficient basis. They do see the dangers to civil rights and liberties. They do see the dangers to privacy. They do see the dangers that intelligence agencies may overstep their mandate, and they may engage in dirty tricks, as it's put, which I think is a far too mild phrase for false flag operations, which actually change history more than a dirty trick.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
You're just talking about how there are the media only goes so far in criticizing Bill C-51. I mean, they're critical, but with some reservations.
Correct. It's more than curious. It's disturbing and it's unfortunate and it's frustrating that the media, even while they're critical of this Bill C-51, and they mention dangers in it, they say it needs more oversight. CSIS needs more oversight, which is pretty obvious. They point to the lack of truth-telling on the part of the government, Jason Kenney and Blaney and Harper himself. They actually using the term lies now. They actually say they're not telling the truth. They've become more bold in their criticisms. Yet they skirt the central fact of the matter, in my opinion, which is that these intelligence agencies, these counterterrorism people, these security establishments, engage in widespread fakery, which we've talked about at the very beginning of this conversation. And that is the elephant in the room that they won't mention. So that all the criticisms of C-51, and I welcome them all, lack the punch they could have if the media, anybody in these media outlets, would just begin to intimate that there are some very suspicious elements to various of the large events that constitute the so-called war on terror. And so they don't do that, so that they have one hand tied behind them, at least, probably more than one hand. And that's one of the main things, I think, that needs to be mentioned about the mainstream media coverage of Bill C-51, which is a key issue for us here right now in this conversation.
I was wondering if there's a comparisons that could be drawn with other parts of the world. I remember, for example, from your book, the Operation Gladio, which took place in Europe, in which it was admitted that there were these the standing army that was overseen by a sort of a secret army that was overseen by Italian intelligence, which essentially was, you know, ostensibly there to protect against another Soviet invasion, but they were actually carrying out false flag operations against civilians. And this is, I mean, this is not conspiracy theory. It's all well established, right?
Well, it certainly is. As a matter of fact, I have right in the window well beside me, because I was rereading it, I'm rereading parts of it, is the Daniel Ganser book, NATO's Secret Armies. That's all about Operation Gladio. And I'm so glad you brought this up, Michael, because this is so germane. As you say, what happened, and it was much more than the Italians, that actually the CIA and MI6 was centrally directive in Operation Gladio in Europe. This was covered 20 or 25 years after World War II. And they brought the Italians into it, and eventually, I believe it was in something like 14 countries. And they enlisted fascistic elements, no question. They enlisted fascistic elements within the police and even from the mafia and so on, in order to carry out these nasty false flag operations, which actually caused quite a loss of life. The worst one was in the Bologna railway station. I believe it was 180-some people were killed, and they were all blamed on socialists or communists. And it was called the strategy of tension, and it did destabilize the politics of these countries in Europe to the extent that it disabled publics from voting democratically for socialists or communists. And the Communist Party was quite large in Italy and Greece at that time, and so they successfully caused chaos and fear and hatred to be directed at the left. And now it seems clear to me, anyway, that what has been done, because that was so successful, false flag operations in general are tremendously successful. And what they've done is they've extended the strategy of attention right around the globe, so that you get these Al-Shabaab and you get ISIS and ISIL and Boko Haram. And there's a lot of evidence that these are all cooked up, basically cooked up. Tremendous meddling by these special forces and psychological warfare people and the likes of the CIA and Mossad and the rest. And I'll just give you one example, just one, because it's only fair to offer some evidence. You may remember the two Japanese chaps who were captured by ISIL. And then there was one picture you may have seen, your listeners may have seen it, where the two Japanese chaps are on their knees in orange jumpsuits. And standing between them is a very tall, black-clad guy with a mask on, brandishing a knife. And, of course, there are Arabic words underneath because allegedly these terrorists wanted to display this horrific image. And so a friend of mine in the States actually said, there's something funny about that photo. And sure enough, there was. And I went to my Toronto Star that I subscribed to, and there was a large color photo. And I hadn't noticed it, but my friend did. It was a sunny day. The sky was clear. But the shadow under the one guy's chin went to the left, definitely. And the shadow under the other guy's chin went to the right, definitely. So at the very least, this was photoshopped. And the Toronto Star just ran that as if this was a real picture. So, I mean, there's actually evidence of the fakery that is involved with a lot of these videos, a lot of the alleged messages from these alleged websites allegedly run by these alleged terrorists. I mean, really, it is. There's a whole world of illusion that is being manipulated, and regrettably, the media that should be the front line in detecting anomalies and absurdities and impossibilities are not doing their job. So that's why I'm afraid I'm in constant frustration about the mainstream media, even while I am willing happily to give credit where credit's due. They skirt around this central world of illusion, but otherwise, you know, they do. It's kind of like a bait-and-switch operation. The media are really, like Noam Chomsky is, basically a bait-and-switch operation. They do enough good, and that includes them being four square against C-51, that they would gain trust and plaudits. But then that's the bait. The switch is the vast omission of the false flag operations, an ongoing, vast, complete, total omission of that. So omission is probably the most powerful weapon the media have.
So does that what does that imply in the Canadian context? Are we on the road to fascism?
Yeah, we are. I think I'm writing a piece about that, and it's surprising how deep and multifaceted that question is that you just put. But if to take either old-fashioned, shall we say, or dated definitions of fascism, such as that that fascism and Nazism, they are not exactly the same as we would detect by looking at the history of, say, Italian fascism and German Nazism. They're not identical. But one thing they have in common, and it's also in common with the Harper government, I don't mind saying that, is its corporatism. So that the idea is to hand over tremendous power, wealth, and influence to the large corporations. And in Germany, you know, the arms makers were really big there, and the banks were too. You know, Messerschmitt and Blohm and Voss, and on it went. And it was true also in Italy. And Harper is very corporatist. He's very much a promoter of big oil, which is the largest industry that has ever existed on the face of the earth. I mean, the petroleum industry is just a $1 trillion industry. And so corporatism is one thing they have in common. And there are so many ways that this corporatism is brought to bear, and it's against the public interest. There are two. Now, again, we go back to some very laudatory work in the Globe and in the Globe and Mail this morning, for instance, about and this might seem off to one side, but it isn't. these savings accounts that tax-free savings accounts TFSAs. And Harper's just announced he's doubling the amount that people can put in from $5,500 to $11,000 that people can put in. So the government does not collect the tax revenue on that money. That money is shielded by a Canadian law that Harper has introduced. And so in an op-ed page piece in the Globe and Mail this morning, oh, it might have been an op-ed page piece in the Star, come to think of it, by a woman who has lots of bona fides named Frances Woolley, W-O-O-L-L-E-Y, well worth looking up. And then Rob Carrick, who is the Globe and Mail's personal finance editor, has a big piece in the report on business section of the Globe this morning. Both of them are saying the same thing. They're saying this is really, really bad policy because it is going to rob the federal government of the ability to collect taxes very seriously, going on over at least 20 years. And it'll be billions and billions of dollars of lost revenue over the, you know, the lifetimes of people who are alive today to read these stories in the Globe, because they'll put their money in there and the government will never, ever get taxes on it. And so that's in aid of shrinking government. So when you shrink government, you cannot provide social services and so on. And you can't fund pensions, and you can't fund unemployment insurance and health care and education and all the things that are for the public good. But it really benefits the corporate sector. And it benefits generally rich people. And there you have two people in the Globe and Mail today pointing that out very clearly, and they have both have great bona fides. So there are so many ways that Harper, for instance, is engaging in fascistic strategies.
Mm. Well, on that somewhat grim outlook, I think we'll have to leave it there. But Barry Zwicker, thank you very much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour and expanding on these concerns.
You're very welcome. Thanks for your interest.
And we've been speaking with author, journalist, and media critic Barry Zwicker. He's blogging for Truth and Shadows, and he's also has a book coming out soon. At some point, he's working on the book. It's called False Flag Operations: History's Great Deadliest Deceits and Why They Matter. We'll be right back.
For the duration of the program, we will be taking a close look at the anti-terrorism legislation being moved forward in the Canadian Parliament. The bill, C-51, referred to as the Anti-Terrorism Act, acts in conjunction with Bill C-44, the so-called Protection of Canada from Terrorists Act, to address crimes linked to the threat of terror or terrorism in Canada. It was Bill C-44 which coincidentally had been prepared for tabling the same week as the rampage by Michael Zihab Bibeau on Parliament Hill. This bill was finally passed on February 2nd. Bill C-51 was introduced to Parliament on January 30th. After some deliberation, the bill came to a vote on Monday, February 23rd. The governing Conservative Party voted to support the bill. The opposition Liberals voted to support the bill in principle, although with the caveat they would make amendments once they came to power. The opposition NDP and Green parties voted against the bill. Bill C-51 is now being discussed before the House Committee on National Security and Defense. Pending approval, it will eventually be reintroduced to the House of Commons for a final vote before it is enacted into law. There are several aspects to the legislation that has caused concern to environmentalists, indigenous groups, civil rights advocates, and legal experts. The first of these is the criminalization of advocacy and promotion of, quote-unquote, terrorism offenses in general. The provision is found in Part 3 of the bill and is an amendment to the Criminal Code of Canada. Section 83.221 reads as follows. Every person who, by communicating statements, knowingly advocates or promotes the commission of terrorism offenses in general, other than an offense under the sixth section, while knowing that any of those offenses will be committed or being reckless as to whether any of those offenses may be committed as a result of such communication, is guilty of an indictable offense and is liable to imprisonment for a term of not more than 5 years. There are concerns that this amendment will put a chill on free speech. Opinions by journalists and academics, for example, supporting the idea of material support for Ukrainian insurgencies targeting Russian oil infrastructure as a pressure tactic to vacate Ukraine, could thereby be criminalized. What's more, this restriction would apply to private speech obtained through clandestine wiretaps. In the words of Mi'kmaq lawyer and Ryerson University professor Pam Palmiter, quote, any one of us could go to jail for thinking or voicing our opinions, unquote. A second problematic feature of the proposed legislation is the power it gives to Canada's spy agency, CSIS, to actively, quote, take measures within or outside Canada to reduce, very broadly defined, threats to the security of Canada, unquote. The new legislation will fundamentally restructure the 30-year-old agency, giving it essentially policing powers beyond mere information gathering. This legislation gives CSIS the latitude to take measures that they determine to be a threat to the security of Canada. These threats include not only violence against persons, but also foreign-influenced activities within or relating to Canada that are detrimental to the interests of Canada and are clandestine or deceptive or involve a threat to any person. There are exceptions for advocacy and protest, but only if they are lawful. So, for example, if a project like the Keystone XL pipeline is deemed by the Canadian government to be a priority and strongly in the Canadian interest, then CSIS could, theoretically, provide misinformation to an anonymous foreign environmental funder in an effort to deter that funder from continuing to secretly fund a Canadian environmental group planning a protest of that pipeline without the requisite permit. Other powers that would be granted to CSIS would include breaking into a private home in order to destroy equipment CSIS believes may be used to wreck pipelines, infecting and destroying the computers of a radical environmental group believed responsible for tree spiking, but for whom there is insufficient evidence for criminal charges, working with the Canadian Border Services Agency to prevent the travel to Canada of foreign anti-globalization protesters believed to be associated with a planned and possibly violent public protest at an international summit hosted in Toronto,
working with Foreign Affairs and the CBSA to prevent the return to Canada of a citizen who is feared to pose a potential future risk in terms of political violence. Bringing down a website that CSIS believes may be about to begin recruiting to a group engaged in political violence. Starting a cyber whisper smear campaign in order to discredit among his peers an individual regarded as the nucleus of a group that CSIS fears may be radicalizing to political violence. Breaking into a private residence to destroy chemicals that CSIS believes may be precursors to a bomb to be used by a radical secessionist movement. Moreover, the legislation conceives of a special warrant system where breaches of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, such as search and seizure, could be approved in advance by a federal court judge. Warrants are designed to prevent violations of rights, not authorize them in advance. Another concern with the Anti-Terrorism Act is the way it relaxes constraints on information sharing around, quote-unquote, activities that undermine the security of Canada. This kind of unaccountable information sharing with U.S. authorities is what led to the rendition of Canadian Maher Arar to Syria to be tortured. Another objection to this legislation is the way in which it authorizes judges to delete what is called terrorist propaganda from the internet. This could once again constitute a suppression of free speech and encompass thoughts and views not linked to actual violence or threats of violence. Another concern expressed by mainstream media and politicians alike, including NDP leader Thomas Mulcair, is the lack of parliamentary oversight. Unlike the US and the UK, the Canadian plan has no elected officials watching over the activities of CSIS. This raises concerns of the abuse of the new powers of this secretive agency. In a nutshell, the prime concern is that the blueprint is in place for the construction of a secret police in Canada. This examination of the major concerns with Bill C-51, the Anti-Terrorism Act, is drawn from the analysis of two Canadian professors of law, Kent Roach and Craig Forsays. These are found in Four Backgrounders on Bill C-51. Listeners are encouraged to access them through the link www.antiterrorismlaw.ca.
Come get out of the way, boys. Quick, get out of the way. You'd better watch what you say, boys. Better watch what you say. We've rammed in your harbor and tied to your port, and our pistols are hungry and our tempers are short. So bring your daughters around to the fore. 'Cause we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world. We pick and choose as we please, boys. Pick and choose as we please. You'd best get down on your knees, boys. Best get down on your knees. We're hairy and horny and ready to shack, and we don't care if you're yellow or black. Just take off your clothes and lay down on your back. 'Cause we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world. Our boots are needing a shine, boys. Boots are needing a shine. But our Coca-Cola is fine, boys. Coca-Cola is fine. We've got to protect all our citizens fair. So we'll send a battalion for everyone there. And maybe we'll leave in a couple of years. 'Cause we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world. And dump the reds in a pile, boys. Dump the reds in a pile. You'd better wipe off that smile, boys. better wipe off that smile. We'll spit through the streets of the cities we wreck, and we'll find you a leader that you can elect. Those treaties we signed were a pain in the neck. Cause we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world. And clean the Johns with a rag, boys. Clean the Johns with a rag. If you like, you can use your flag, boys. If you like, you can use your flag. We've got too much money, we're looking for toys. And guns will be guns, and boys will be boys. But we'll gladly pay for all we destroy. Cause we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world. Please stay off of the grass, boys. Please stay off of the grass. Here's a kick in the ass, boys. Here's a kick in the ass. We'll smash down your doors. We don't bother to knock. We've done it before, so why all the shock? We're the biggest and the toughest kids on the block. And we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world. And when we butchered your sons, boys, when we butchered your sons, have a stick of our gum, boys. Have a stick of our bubble gum. We own half the world, oh say can you see? And the name for our profits is democracy. So like it or not, you will have to be free. Cause we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.